You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, food pantries around the state are working overtime to help people facing hunger in their communities. We'll hear from one based in Dane County about their efforts to provide easy meals for families during the pandemic. First, we've gotten used to having plenty of new television pretty much all the time. And this hasn't really changed in the last few months, despite the pandemic halting all movie and TV production. Many of the streaming platforms took the pop culture spotlight over the last few months with some of their content, like this one you might recognize.
I really believe in life that you can only be good at one thing.
He's going to get nasty with me.
With saving the cats, it's one thing that I can fix if I can just stay focused on that. So I don't read the newspaper. I don't watch news on television unless there's a cat involved.
That's the voice of Carol Baskin, one of the stars of the Netflix documentary Tiger King, released in March. But as the pandemic continues, the streaming stream could start to dry up. Allison Herman is a staff writer at The Ringer, writing about television and culture. She wrote the piece headlined, "We're Going to Run Out of TV." Allison, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you tell us how COVID impacted production of TV shows?
Of course. I mean, like a lot of industries, it's no longer considered safe to gather together in an enclosed space. And unlike a lot of industries, Hollywood can't go remote, or some parts of it can. So you see a lot of late night television shows, or even we've recently seen award shows switch their format, but ultimately preserve their function. But if you're talking about a scripted show that needs an enclosed indoor set with hundreds of crew members and dozens of actors, including background players, that's not really something you can do while you're under a general state of quarantine. And I'm in California, where we sort of tried a reopening that ultimately turned out to be premature, and that was going to be when certain forms of television production would resume after what I think they assumed would only be a few months hiatus. And now we're finding that we don't really have the conditions to go back to making new TV, even as there's a finite supply of quote unquote old, or at least already produced TV.
And I had thought, you know, Los Angeles when I think of TV production, but you write in your piece also some states offer tax exemptions that brings a lot of production, states like Georgia and Louisiana, places dealing with coronavirus troubles of their own. So even going on the road isn't necessarily going to help TV get back up and running.
Right, because if you think about it, the policy behind these tax incentives is largely favored by Republican governors who consider themselves to be pro-business. That was certainly a really large part of the Georgia tax incentive. But those are the same kinds of state governments that have proven reluctant to impose stringent public health measures like mask orders and insisting that restaurants and other forms of businesses remain closed. So you're ending up with this really awful overlap where the exact parts of the nation that have become these hotbeds of film and TV production are also the parts that it's going to be the hardest to resume activities like film and TV production.
Well, let's start to talk about what viewers are seeing, or I guess not seeing, because of this. What were the types of shows that have been hardest hit, and the types of mediums for sharing these shows that have been hardest hit so far?
Yes. I mean, one of the things I talked about in my original piece about this was it almost feels like coronavirus is just exacerbating pre-existing trends or divides within entertainment. So if you're a company like Netflix and you have really deep pockets and you're used to kind of working a little further ahead, Netflix's Ted Sarandos has already said, we actually expect to be fine in terms of content through the remainder of 2020 and maybe even a little bit into 2021. But conventional broadcast networks, so your NBCs, your CBSs, your whatever, they're both used to kind of producing on a faster turnaround. So you'll shoot something a month or two before it airs as opposed to a full year before it airs. And they just rely more on that type of programming. So you end up with these bizarre spectacles, like NBC's Upfront presentation this year was also packaged as a Zoom reunion of 30 Rock, which, you know, sort of successfully distracted from the fact that we don't really know the futures of these types of shows. I was just reading today about how Grey's Anatomy on ABC, of course, has said, we plan to really address coronavirus and the pandemic in the upcoming season, which they are writing because you can write shows remotely. But there's sort of this caveat in the piece of, we're going to address this in the season, but we don't actually know when we're going to make the season. And Grey's Anatomy is precisely the kind of show that I think is going to be really affected by this.
And you wrote, and I had missed this at the time, a couple shows ended their seasons with some, you know, non-animated shows went to some animated episodes.
Yes, the one that I specifically looked to was The Blacklist, which is a procedural, and they did this, what I thought was actually a very inventive workaround, where their what turned out to be the last episode of the season was half animated, but in a way that was stylized to look like a comic book. So it wasn't totally out of the tonal realm of the show, but of course, if you're used to seeing James Spader in the flesh, it's a little jarring.
Allison Herman is with us, staff writer at The Ringer, writing about television and culture. She's talking about how the pandemic is going to slow down, maybe even stop the TV content pipeline in a way that we're going to start noticing more and more over time. All right, Allison, that's broadcast. You said Netflix, Deep Pockets, they apparently have a lot of stuff already in the can waiting to edit and release, but that can't go on forever, can it?
It can't go on forever. And I think at that point, you're going to end up going into the hypothetical realm. But to speculate a little bit, Netflix, in addition to having Deep Pockets, is also a global and international corporation. And so what we're sort of seeing as the pandemic plays out is that certain countries are more prepared to resume going back to normal life, which includes film and TV production, than others. So I wouldn't be surprised to see something like what we've seen happen in sports, where, you know, we've turned to, or American sports viewers have turned to things like German soccer or Korean baseball to kind of fill the gap before American sports leagues figure out their own way to restart. So it's all a form of kicking the can down the road, but that also gives companies more time to come up with workarounds.
Is there a thing where they're digging more and more into their archives and the content they might have just had sitting on a shelf, real or metaphorical, somewhere, and repackaging and putting it back out?
Yeah, I've seen a few calls for shows to or networks to air their unaired pilots, like the first episodes of shows that they ultimately decided not to go forward making into series. HBO is infamous. There are all these unproduced projects that I'm sure people would love to see. I think another thing is also, we're definitely going to run out of new TV, but because there has been so much TV produced and we have all these new outlets. So, for example, NBC Universal's Peacock just launched last week, and that has all these old seasons of older shows. There's still a lot of stuff for people to watch and consume. You're just losing that feeling of everyone consuming the same new thing at the same time, which I feel like is a real loss.
Is this going to change the content instead of, hey, our show has scenes in crowded clubs in downtown Atlanta or whatever? Our show now has scenes of two people walking in the woods near no one else.
I've certainly heard about that. Although, again, I think that was kind of done on the assumption of we'll be able to resume some form of film production, just not like the same version where you could just casually have 200 people walking around an outdoor mall or something like that. So I think that's possible. I've also heard that animated shows and demand for them, not the unintentional animation that we were just talking about earlier, but just straightforward animation, is easier to convert to remote production. So a lot of networks I've heard are really interested in exploring those concepts. But that has its own drawbacks in that animation actually just takes a longer time, even in normal circumstances. So you could order a bunch of animated shows now, and we might find that we'll already have a vaccine, but we're just going to get a whole raft of new cartoons.
Now, Allison, for people out there who have burned through the stuff they wanted to watch, what would you point them toward in terms of new releases on any platform?
Sure. I think a new show that I'm certainly not alone in enjoying, but I won't hesitate to recommend, is a show called I May Destroy You on HBO. It's written, largely co-directed by and starring a woman named Michaela Cole, who made a sitcom called Chewing Gum that's widely available on Netflix in the United States. Chewing Gum was a little more of a coming-of-age story about a young woman coming to grips with her own sexuality while growing up in public housing in London. And this is also autobiographical, but it's a show about a young woman in London who's working as a writer who is sexually assaulted the night before a writing deadline, which is based on something that also happened to Cole. And it's a show that is funny and difficult and constantly changing its tone. And it just has that feeling of something really special that's heightened by the fact that this might be the last special communal thing we get for a while, or one of the last.
And then a personal question, Allison. I always wonder about TV writers these days, knowing that there's no way you can ever catch up with a fire hose of new content out there. Do you feel like you actually might be able to now with the slowdown?
I won't lie. It's almost, you know, as concerned as I am for both what I'm going to cover and, of course, the thousands and thousands of jobs that are being impacted by this, there's a small measure of relief of being able to say, you know, like, maybe I can go back and check out these things that I missed. So, for example, a show I talked about in my piece that was cut off prematurely is The Good Fight on CBS All Access, which I love. But the creators of that also produced a show called Evil on CBS, which is a sort of supernatural procedural, like The Exorcist meets Law and Order. And I went back and got to visit it for the first time a few weekends ago. And it's a lovely watch that I also highly recommend. So that's been a nice treat for me personally.
Allison, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Allison Herman is a staff writer at The Ringer, writing about television and culture. She wrote the piece, "We're Going to Run Out of TV." We have that linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll find out how a Dane County food pantry is adapting to conditions under COVID-19 by providing at-home meal kits. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the president held a coronavirus briefing yesterday at the White House, something that hasn't been done for months. We'll find out what he said and check out other big stories in our weekly look at national politics. First, food banks and pantries across the state have seen an increase in demand as the COVID-19 pandemic has caused people to either lose their jobs temporarily or permanently. Our next guest joins us to talk about how their food pantry is adapting to COVID-19 in order to meet the needs of residents throughout Dane County. Helen Osborne Senatus is the program manager at the River Food Pantry. Helen, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm excited, really excited to be here.
And Chris Tuttle is the River Food Pantry's chef. Chef Chris, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Helen, let's start with you. How has your food pantry been impacted by the ongoing pandemic?
Yes. Before the pandemic, all of our services were within our building, but, you know, that was one of the first changes we had to make, was moving everything to curbside. And one of our services was our community meals, which was great just because it was a fresh, hot, nutritious meal available for households when they came to get groceries. And sadly, that was one of the first things that we had to discontinue. Just, you know, having a lot of people sitting closely eating together was kind of going against all the health code recommendations. So we moved everything outside, so it's all curbside right now. So everyone, you know, either walks up or drives up, and we're able to provide a week's worth of groceries, right outside. And it's a pretty quick process. And we, just kind of looking at some numbers, one of the biggest things that stands out is the number of households coming to the river for the very first time. Looking at, you know, the time span from mid-March when we had to change our operations through last week, and comparing that time frame this year to last year, we've actually signed up over 1,000 brand new households who'd never been to the river before, and that's about an 80% increase compared to last year at the time. So that's just one thing that speaks to the growing need of food pantries and the growing concern about food stability for households.
That's a huge jump, Helen. Do you have enough food to keep up with that huge increase?
Yes. Our operations team, our director of operations, is amazing at being able to get food. And, you know, luckily there's been a lot available. Second Harvest is one of our largest partner and our local food bank. And so we've been able to get a lot of food from them and also other partners in the community. And yes, we have plenty of food. Luckily, yeah, we're able to meet the demand.
Chris, let's turn to you now. As chef at River Food Pantry, you've had to make this transition from these on-site community meals to these food kits. Talk about what you're doing to, you know, give some of that meal experience, even though it can't be on-site.
We like to see all the people. We get to know them that come in. Now we're basically, after they pick up food that's loaded up into their car from the market. The next stop is the drive-through family meal, and it took us a couple months from the time when the indoor meal was canceled until we were able to launch this program. We had limited amount of people that we could have in the building at any time, and age restrictions kept us from being able to launch it immediately. But it's been going about a month now, and it's going pretty strong. It's going good. I think it's working out pretty well.
Now, can you talk about the challenge of, instead of preparing a meal that's ready to eat, preparing a meal that's ready to cook when people get home?
Not too much different. We just got a wonderful blast chiller. We get the stuff down to temp, and it's about the same, except we have to package it and, get it done ahead of time, not just put it out buffet style. So, it limits what we can, how many options we can give them. But so far, we've been able to put out consistently pretty good meals with nutritious ingredients. We try to get vegetables or salads into each meal, try to get nutrition out into the community is one of our goals.
We're talking about a food pantry response to COVID-19, increased demand, and it changes the conditions where the food can be prepared and distributed. We have Helen Osborne-Senatus with us and Chris Tuttle. They're both with River Food Pantry in Dane County. Helen, can you talk a little a bit about the response to this program now, this food kit program?
Yes, our first couple weeks we actually put out a survey just so we could get some direct feedback as folks were taking home the meals. And, overall, people are really appreciative and enjoying having a ready-made meal that there's little to no prep, beyond just reheating. And so it's really easy for families who might be in transition or, living from one place to another or are just very busy. And so it's response has been really positive. And even for staff as well, it's just great to be able to provide this service. Our interim executive director, Rhonda Adams, has been here for about 8 years. And the community meal was always one of, something she was really proud of and excited to be able to offer. And so being able to have this again, just kind of in a different form is just, we're all really happy to be able to provide it.
And Chris, I know the coronavirus has had an impact on restaurant kitchens and how they can work. Has this changed the way you and the team there actually do the job and work together? What kind of challenges has that posed?
Well, it's kept us farther apart in the kitchen. Luckily, we have a big facility where we're sort of like a warehouse with a huge kitchen and other operations set up in it. So as we've gone on through time and gotten better at, thinking ahead of how we're going to set things up in terms of prepping the food and cooking it and all the things you have to do with the food, we now have, banquet tables where people are set up generally 20, 30 feet apart. I just make sure there's a workstation created for them and everything's ready when they come in. And it's not too bad. Like I said, luckily we have plenty of space. If this was a small facility, I think we'd have a very difficult time. Like most kitchens are pretty small. We're pretty fortunate.
And Chris, do you, when you're preparing a meal for people to make at home, do you think about people who might have, not as much access to that full kitchen? How simple do you have to keep it, given that people might be preparing this food in different settings?
Yeah, that's a good point that we thought about quite a bit before we launched the program, exactly what are our biggest concerns. And I guess we just assume everybody has some way of heating it up for the most part, but if they don't, we do a lot of cold sandwiches and things like that. We mix it up. But generally, if there's a microwave or a stovetop, you can just, put the spaghetti in the pot and reheat it or stew or whatever it is that we have.
And Helen, I know people around the state who are in better financial shape right now might be wondering how they could help out a food bank like yours or others around the state. What are some of the best ways for people to help out?
Oh, yes, definitely. Actually, right now we have a match from a donor, a matching gift up to $25,000 for money donated towards FAM before September 1st. And That's all, you know, on our website, riverfoodpantry.org. So, I mean, you know, monetary donations are always very much appreciated just because it helps keep our shelves stocked and helps us feeding the community. Also, another great way is coming and volunteering. You know, Chris is our chef, and he's in the kitchen and leading the volunteers through helping prepare and serve these meals. So, you know, if you have some time, we'd love to see you.
And Chris, I know, you know, when I cook for my family or whoever, I like to see them eat the food. Do you miss that experience of having the people on site and seeing how the meals go over?
No, definitely. Yeah. In fact, one of our future goals is to at least have some sort of maybe an outdoor meal during the summer on once a week, maybe Fridays. And I try to get out and actually do the handout when I can. Once in a while I get to, and it's nice to see all the old faces. It's really great to talk to them again. So, it is. It's the one big negative about this program. It's a good program. It's working well, but not being able to see all the people that we've gotten to know, that's one thing we miss.
And Helen, what are you looking for over the next couple months? What else might be in store there at the pantry?
Well, here at the pantry, I mean, we're just, you know, we've, like I said, had to change operations, in a lot of ways, in big ways, but kind of just looking at, you know, for continued community feedback, just so we can make sure that we're serving our community as best we can. And this is just phase one of FAM. And like Chris said, you know, maybe doing a meal on site or potentially in the future. Right now, families can come once a week to get the meal. And so hopefully in the future, being able to expand that to multiple times during the week or getting it out into neighborhoods. Just looking at as many options as there are and then working towards them.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. We really appreciate we really appreciate being here.
Thanks a lot.
We've been talking to Helen Osborne-Senatus, Program Manager at the River Food Pantry. Chris Tuttle is the River Food Pantry's chef. They joined us today to tell us how the pantry is working to provide healthy meals for people and families throughout Dane County as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. Coming up after the news, is Congress coming to a consensus on additional economic relief for coronavirus? We'll get the latest from a congressional correspondent. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Department of Health Services reported more than 1,000 new cases of COVID-19 in Wisconsin yesterday, a new single-day record. We'll talk to a doctor about the rise in cases and how to reverse that trend. First, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. President Trump announced today the government will be sending federal law enforcement agents to Chicago and Albuquerque with the stated goal of combating rising crime there, as the president and Attorney General William Barr put it. This comes as Homeland Security is pushing back against criticism of its use of force in Portland. Also, the president alone held his first coronavirus briefing after a long pause. And with supplemental unemployment benefits from the federal government close to running out, Congress, the White House, and even the Republican Party are at odds on how to move forward with another economic relief package. You can join in on that at 800-642-1234. The House already passed a relief package. What do you think about it? Should the Senate pick that one up, about $3 trillion? How about Mitch McConnell's plan to undercut the House, say about a $1 trillion relief package? Still waiting for details on what's going to come out of that. If you're benefiting from the $600 aid, let us know. Let us know how an end of that might affect you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Mascaro is Chief Congressional Correspondent for AP. Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. How are you?
Good, and I understand you've got some weather there, so hopefully all will go well.
Yeah, I'm here in Washington, D.C., in the nation's capital. You know, we have these afternoon thunder showers often in the summer months when it gets really, really hot and sweltering during the day, and then the showers come in. But this one is real thunder and lightning, and they were issuing some some flash flood warnings. So everyone's kind of hunkered down at the moment as the skies darkened.
All right. Well, good luck to everybody there. Well, let's look at this this press conference, coronavirus press conference. First one in a while. And just the president alone on this one. Could you talk about this as kind of a significant news event?
It sure was. You know, it was sort of a real change in tone from the president. Our team at the White House did a number of different takeouts on his appearance yesterday. He did a couple main things. One, he says, you know, that the virus outbreak is going to worsen before it gets better, which is something that, you know, health officials have been saying for quite some time. But, you know, the president had previously been painting more of a rosy picture of sort of the way things were going. The president also pulled out a mask. You know, he has repeatedly sort of dismissed the idea of wearing masks as a way to contain the spread of the virus, even though, you know, the CDC director just last week had said, gosh, if every American could just put on a mask, it would really go a long way toward reducing the spread. You know, these particles, when people talk and when they're in close quarters, you know, they just apparently really can spread. And so the president talked about the importance of wearing a mask and sort of taking it out of the political context, you know, sort of trying to make it not really about whether you're for or against the president, but just do it for public health. And, you know, that seemed to be a turnaround and something that was really applauded by a lot of people because they think it could help. You know, there is this mounting death toll, you know, up to, gosh, I think we're at 142 and climbing 142,000 overnight and into today. And the infection rate, as you know, is really high in a number of states, seeing a lot of cases and a lot of emergency room visits. So so that's what we had yesterday. And, you know, he'll be back today for another briefing.
Yeah, let's give a listen to the president yesterday, an example of the tone he took.
Some areas of our country are doing very well. Others are doing less well. It will probably, unfortunately, get worse before it gets better. Something I don't like saying about things, but that's the way it is. It's the way, it's what we have. You look over the world, it's all over the world. And it tends to do that. The governors are working very, very hard.
Another notable thing about the conference, though, was the absence of other government officials, Vice President Pence, who had been head of the coronavirus task force, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Deborah Birx. It was just the president.
Yes, that's right. It was really a chance for President Trump to do what he thinks he does really well, is just speak directly to the American people. And, you know, that has its sort of pluses and minuses, people say. Politically, it has a benefit for him. He has shown in the past that he can sort of command the stage. You know, others, Democrats in particular, Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader of the Senate, said the president should just stay away. You know, he often gives information that is, you know, misleading, if not wrong, when he sort of talked about, you know, that the virus would, you know, just disappear and would, you know, you could get rid of it by some of these different, you know, I hate to even say them because I know public health officials really worry about them. Right. But he had mentioned some treatments that people could take that people in the public health realm, you know, do sort of warn against. And so, so, you know, you do have this sort of mixed view on whether it's good for the president to be out there on his own or whether the briefing might benefit from the public health experts.
And one, before we move on from this briefing, I want to turn to an odd moment when the president was taking questions, not just about coronavirus, from reporters. One asked the president to comment on the arrest of Ghislaine Maxwell, accomplice confidant of the late Jeffrey Epstein, herself now arrested and charged with sex trafficking and lying to investigators. Here's what the president said.
I don't know. I haven't really been following it too much. I just wish her well, frankly. I've met her numerous times over the years, especially since I lived in Palm Beach, and I guess they lived in Palm Beach. But I wish her well, whatever it is. I don't know.
I know we're not in normal times, but the president wishing well to a central figure in this, you know, with a lot of allegations anyway, in this big sex abuse scandal. Did this get a lot of reaction?
Yes, it certainly did. And, you know, that whole story is just tragic with the Jeffrey S. Epstein case and, you know, what has happened there. And I think just as you saw, the reaction was swift, you know, from many quarters, just people saying that this was not something that the president should be talking about in that way from the podium.
We're looking at some of the top stories in national politics right now. It's our weekly look at the news in from Washington. Lisa Mascaro is with us, chief congressional correspondent for AP. You can join in on our next topic at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see from Congress when it comes to more economic recovery and relief? What do you think? Do we need another big investment, extended, enhanced unemployment benefits? 800-642-1234. This is one I know you have been covering closely, Lisa. What is the latest from especially the Senate on this?
Well, Sonny, you should ask. We are all sort of poised here. Senate Leader Mitch McConnell, there were some signs that he would be unveiling his package today, and we're hoping we don't have it right now while we're on the phone, but there, you know, there are some signs that it would come today or certainly tomorrow. And this would be basically the Republicans' response to the package that Speaker Pelosi passed back in May. She passed a through the Democratic House the $3 trillion HEROES Act, a big sweeping proposal with lots of aid and different programs we can talk about in response to the virus outbreak. You know, at the time, Congress had just passed an earlier big bill, the largest of its kind really in U.S. history, in March. And so Leader McConnell really just wanted to take a pause and said, we're not going to chase this $3 trillion package that Speaker Pelosi has put down. It's a liberal wish list, and we're just going to hit pause and sort of see how things go. Well, you know, in the time sense, as we have seen, a lot of states reopened. Folks thought maybe the unemployment rate would improve. You know, businesses could reopen. And in fact, what's happened is sort of the opposite, right? We're seeing, you know, the virus spread, states having to contract again, businesses having to close their doors again or severely limit, you know, some of their public operations. And so the Republicans are putting together a response. The problem right now is that there are deep, deep divisions, not just among the Republicans there in Congress, you know, the real deficit hawks, the real, you know, conservatives who oppose the big spending versus those Republicans that are willing to sort of engage and have more spending and federal programs out there. But also with the White House, you know, President Trump has some priorities that he really wants in this package. And they do not align with what the Senate Republicans want. Now, you know, Senate Republicans have the majority there in the Senate, just like Democrats have the majority over in the House. And so, you know, this disconnect is really just going to force Leader McConnell and Nancy Pelosi to have to negotiate. And that's where they're at right now. So we'll see if Leader McConnell is able to produce what he calls sort of a draft, a starting point. But even, you know, today there are signs they're just having a very hard time getting it together. And we can certainly drill down on those details if you want to hear more about some of the different provisions that they're considering.
We'll dig into some of those details in just a few moments with AP's chief congressional correspondent, Lisa Mascaro. It's our Week in Washington segment, looking at the big news in national politics. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from Congress, if anything, when it comes to more relief, economic relief efforts? The unemployment benefits, the enhancer from the federal government, that's expiring real soon. Should it be extended? That's $600 a week. Should it be extended in full or just part of it? There's some talk about that we're going to get into in just a few moments. Have you benefited from it? Do you worry that it costs too much or share concerns that it keeps people from looking for work? Are there other efforts you'd like to see to help small businesses, maybe your own small business? Or do you have questions about what's coming from either side, House, Senate, White House, Democrats, Republicans? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with AP's chief congressional correspondent, Lisa Mascaro, looking at some of the top stories this week out of Washington, D.C. Lisa, let's pick up where we left off. The ticking time clock for Congress on relief efforts is the end of this enhanced unemployment benefit. Can you talk about that expiration and what they're saying in Congress about if and how they'd want to continue it?
Yes, this is one of the big sticking points, not only between the Republicans themselves, but the Republicans and the Democrats. So as part of the earlier aid package that Congress approved and President Trump signed into law back in March, they added a $600 weekly benefit boost. So, you know, states have different unemployment benefits. You know, they're all set sort of locally, and it sort of matches, you know, different priorities in the regions. For many people, the benefits can be very low in their states. And with the widespread uncertainty, Congress agreed to give this extra $600 weekly boost just to make sure families could weather this crisis. It was expected to last for about 120 days. Well, we're coming up on that expiration. Republicans warn that this boost is really preventing some people from going back to work. They have evidence from some business leaders that it's just hard to get employees to return when they could be making more in some parts of the country on the unemployment benefit than regular sort of moderate wage jobs. Some people dispute that, but Republicans feel strongly that is the case. Some of them want to completely just get rid of the benefit. Some of them want to just lower it. So they're trying to figure out how to do that. And as you might imagine, you know, everything's complicated, right? You know, the state unemployment offices are already overwhelmed processing all of these claims, millions of Americans suddenly being jobless. And so the state unemployment offices have really struggled to kind of keep up with the demand right now. And so how do you put a new sort of federal idea on them and say, okay, how we're going to do that? And so they're trying to figure that out. Democrats want to extend the benefit. They say, let's just keep it going. It's a lifeline to cash-strapped Americans. Whatever the Republicans come up with, they're going to then have to go negotiate it with Democrats. And it's a mess. The benefit does begin to expire soon, in a matter of days. It'll start getting phased out by the end of the week here. And so they are under pressure to get something done or maybe provide some sort of stopgap measure to hold them over while they negotiate further.
Another sticking point has to do with support for state and local governments. Relevant here in Wisconsin as the governor calls on his cabinet to look for budget cuts because of declining revenues, because of the economic slowdown. What is the state of conversation on whether another federal relief package would give money to state and local governments?
Yeah, the state and local government issue is another huge sticking point. Speaker Pelosi's bill gave almost $1 trillion to the state and local governments. If you look at some of the organizations that represent the state and local governments, they say that they are facing massive budget shortfalls as, you know, their public hospitals, their emergency responders, all of this have tried to react to the virus crisis. A lot of Republicans say, look, you know, these states have been overspending. And as one senator, Rick Scott from Florida, told reporters yesterday, you know, I don't want Florida to have to bail out New York. And so there is this big difference of opinion, you know, $1 trillion from Pelosi. And right now it's kind of sounding like zero from the Republican side. The Republicans say the previous aid bill had provided about $150 billion for the state, and that the local cities and other county jurisdictions have had a hard time accessing that money. And so they want to kind of reshuffle the money and loosen some of the restrictions to make it easier for the local cities and counties to tap into some of the remaining funds that are out there from that previous bill. And so I think they're looking more at let's see what we've already given and see if we can kind of reshuffle some of that money versus, Democrats had asked for this very large amount, because they're warning, Democrats are warning that if you cut off money to, states and cities, these people like to sort of, complain about government workers or say, these are the teachers and the firefighters and the, public health workers and, a lot of the trash, collection, all these kind of frontline sort of people that we're talking about right now. So that's a big battle ahead.
We're talking to Lisa Mascaro from the Associated Press. We're looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's turn to another story now. The president announced he would be sending some federal law enforcement officers to more cities now. Portland, Oregon has been the center of this story, and I want to give a listen to Acting Secretary of Homeland Security Chad Wolf defending the actions of what he said are simply CPB, U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers. He says calling organized violence against federal property in that city.
These police officers are not stormtroopers. They are not the Gestapo, as some have described them. That description is offensive, it's hyperbolic, and it's dishonest. And every law enforcement officer and every reasonable American knows this. While I look forward to the day that our officers are redeployed back to their regular day-to-day mission, we will not shrink from our duty because of this violence.
Can you talk about the back and forth of this at the national level of the deployment of these law enforcement officers, federal law enforcement officers to Portland?
Yeah, this is a really new and different situation. We just have not really seen a massive show of force like this from federal enforcement. I mean, certainly when there are civil disturbances and, problems in different areas, you see the National Guard, being called in by the governors. But this is a real different situation where you have the federal government coming in, sometimes over the objections, right? I mean, the Attorney General in Oregon is filed suit, to stop the federal government from coming in this way. And the president has talked about wanting to send more troops out. Some see a real political play here where the president is able to sort of flex, he has talked about being a law and order president, sort of taking this tough on law and order approach that plays well to a lot of his base of supporters. And, it is seen in through that lens, yet at the same time, there's a real constitutional question here of how much the federal, law enforcement power is able to reach into the jurisdictions. I mean, the country has a long history of the separation of federal, and state powers. And this is a new sort of zone. Some of these federal troops do have authority to operate in some of these states. But, when you are seeing resistance from the states, is it still appropriate? In Congress, the House Democrats are calling for oversight. They want to hear from federal officials on this. Even some senators, Republican senators, had mentioned that today as well. So there is a lot of rising concern about where this is going and to what extent, it is, within bounds.
We'll leave it there for now. Lisa, a lot going on this week. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, great. Thanks. Nice to join you.
That's Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press. She was with us to talk about some of the top stories out of Washington this week, including negotiations back and forth over the next coronavirus economic relief package amid a looming deadline we mentioned of federal enhanced unemployment benefits expiring. Got a couple emails on related topics. Cheryl writes, quote, I know what we don't need, a liability waiver for businesses that forced their employees to work when they were sick with COVID and did too little too late to prevent the spread of COVID in the workplace. Cheryl goes on, we do not need a payroll tax cut. If you're not working, it isn't going to help. And so many people are not working. And Matt emails, southern states aren't bailing out states like New York. Quite the opposite. Matt writes, California and New York pay in more than they take. Southern states are on the take in terms of almost every parameter. There's still time to share your thoughts. You can comment on stories linked over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email, as they did, ideas@WPR.org. Or, as always, feel free to tweet us. We are at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR. However you do it, let us know what you want to see next from Congress on economic relief. This week marks the 25th anniversary of one of the best teen movies of all times, according to many movie writers and fans, the movie Clueless, starring Alicia Silverstone and directed by Amy Heckerling, who also did Fast Times at Ridgemont High, a big teen movie for a previous generation. Clueless has legions of hardcore fans who grew up with the movie, among them producer J. Carlisle Larson. Hey, JC.
Hi, Rob.
So you are a Clueless fan, JC. Well, wait, you're a fan of the movie Clueless. Sorry, that sounds like an adjective when I put it before you. You are clueful about Clueless.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool. I'm used to this this harshness from you, Rob. I was a kid, like I was young when the movie came out, so I'm not going to say that I fully understood Clueless at the age of 8, but I will say that I liked it as a kid, even if I didn't get it. But as I got older, and I've now watched it many more times, one, you see just how funny and how pointed it is. I mean, it is a retelling of Emma by Jane Austen, which I didn't know until obviously I was much older. But yeah, it's a movie that has stuck with me. It's still one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. And I recently watched it, because we're in COVID, by distance because with my friend in Philadelphia. So that was super fun.
All right. That's the very clueful J. Carlisle Larson. Thanks for joining us. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.